Hello and welcome everybody to a new U of Care podcast. It is my great pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Erica Levitt. Dr. Levitt, do you mind introducing yourself to our members?
Sure. My name is Dr. Erica Levitt, and I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Pharmacology and Therapeutics here at UF in the College of Medicine.
Wonderful. It's great to have you. Would you mind telling us a little bit about what got you actually interested, initially drawn towards the field of addiction research? Everybody has a little bit of a different background. Some have a personal affiliation or a personal relationship to addiction or substance use disorders. Others are purely interested from a research perspective. So what got you initially interested in the field of addiction research?
Yeah, my interest really started in pharmacy school. So I initiated my career wanting to be a pharmacist. I thought that's what I was going to do. And I went to pharmacy school, got my degree. And during the course of my education, I took a course called Drugs of Abuse. And there we learned all about the pharmacology, all of pharmacological basis of how drugs of abuse work. And I just found that extremely fascinating. And especially fascinating that we knew how all these drugs worked, that people actually are really good pharmacologists when treating themselves, that they know how these drugs work too. And despite all that we know about the pharmacology of the drugs, we still have such a major problem with substance use disorder. So I, you know, during my pharmacy education, I also had the opportunity to do undergraduate research at a couple of universities, at Purdue University and Michigan State University. There I worked on the dopamine system and also cannabinoids, so two different separate projects. And ever since then, all of my research has been at least somehow related to drugs of abuse. So I did my PhD at the University of Michigan studying opioid receptors and how opioid receptors at a very cellular level function and how they depend on the lipid environment that surrounds the receptors in order to function properly. And then after my PhD, what I really wanted to do was learn more about how opioids work in neurons, since what we were doing in my PhD was mostly cell culture. So I went and I did a postdoc at the Volum Institute at Oregon Health and Sciences University. And there I learned how to do whole cell voltage clamp recordings from locus coeruleus neurons, neurons in your brain that really control the amount of norepinephrine that's in our brain. And they all have opioid receptors, and I used those neurons to investigate mechanisms of tolerance. So I know if people take opioids long-term, they will eventually develop some tolerance to those opioids, so they have to take more and more opioid in order to achieve the same effect. So I was looking at some of the cellular and molecular mechanisms that lead to the development of that tolerance. And bringing me to what we do now, it was interesting during my postdoc, started to realize that the tolerance to the respiratory depressant effects of opioids develops more slowly than tolerance to analgesic effects or rewarding effects. So as people were taking more and more opioid for the analgesic or the euphoric effects, they would become more at risk for respiratory depression. And so we thought, well, maybe the cellular mechanisms of how tolerance develops in neurons that control breathing is different from the locus coeruleus neurons, which are more involved in either the pain or the rewarding aspects, depending how you think about it. So that set me down this path of looking at opioid receptors function in the respiratory network. And that's where I started my lab, and that's what we're doing right now at UF generally.
So that has a very important impact on safety, a very important impact on the therapeutic safety margin of opioids in the setting of patient safety, but also obviously when we talk about opioid use disorders, how tolerance then translates into the abuse potential of different drugs, but particularly opioids, right? When we talk about So there are, I assume then, different opioid receptors and how, depending on their location in different brain areas, how they basically behave in response to increased opioid concentrations, right?
Yeah, so that's the problem, is it's the same receptor, the mu opioid receptor that underlies all of the analgesic effects, the euphoric effects, and the respiratory depression and constipation that goes along with opioids. So they deleted this one gene from mice and all of those clinically observed opioid effects disappeared. So that's why it's so difficult to separate the great effects of opioids, they're, you know, wonderful painkillers, from the negative effects, the, you know, addictive promoting properties and the respiratory, dangerous, potentially fatal respiratory depression. That's really hard to separate because it's the same receptor.
Huh. So what I've heard, and I'm not by all means an expert in this area, but that there are kind of two downstream pathways, signaling pathways upon activation of opioid and many other G protein coupled receptors. One is the classical CAMP, second messenger cascade, and then the beta arrestin pathway. And I got interested in kratom pharmacology, and it's kind of this a lot of folks propose that kratom is primarily tailored, or is primarily activating the G protein coupled pathway and not the beta arrestin 2 pathway. Could that potentially contribute if we can figure out how we can only activate the G protein coupled pathway? Do you know anything about this?
I do, actually, quite a bit. It's interesting that you brought this up and that this is where the discussion has landed us. So that was you're right. That's the one prominent hypothesis in the field, is that if you could develop a drug that targeted more the G protein effects and less of the beta arrestin effects, it might be safer. There's actually quite a lot of evidence preclinically that's come out now that hypothesis might not be the main reason that these drugs are safer. The original idea stemmed from mice with the beta arrestin 2 deletion. They showed less respiratory depression. We're up to 4 labs now that have tried to replicate that, and they haven't been able to do so. And a lot of drugs that aren't effective at recruiting beta arrestin are actually low efficacy agonists, meaning partial agonists. Think about buprenorphine. Buprenorphine is a classic example of a partial opioid agonist, and it has a much lower risk of respiratory depression compared to, you know, drugs with higher efficacy. So an alternate theory is that you actually would rather have a balanced agonist that can recruit, you know, activate both G proteins for their physiological effects and arrestin for their normal tolerance developing effects. And that will create a safer drug if it's a low efficacy agonist, or that some of the safety that's been observed with these bias drugs is maybe actually due to the low efficacy rather than the G protein versus arrestin bias. So it's actually kind of an ongoing debate that you've brought up here in this discussion.
Well, if it cannot be replicated, then that's obviously of concern, that there might have been some issues with the original setup or methodology of the experiment when it was conducted. So something more to look into. So when we think about opioids, obviously there's this whole opioid epidemic that is still ongoing and is actually worsening at the moment. And we're thinking about how can we more effectively address it within the clinical setting. You, with a pharmacy background, looking at this now from a more what we call or often referred to as basic science, the basic sciences from a preclinical perspective. But when we talk about tolerance development, we often think about dopamine as kind of the reward neurotransmitter. Is there anything that might also steer us away from potentially activating the dopamine system when it comes to opioid uses. Is there anything that we can do to mitigate that?
This is a little bit outside of what we do, but you know, a lot of the dopamine release is pharmacokinetic dependent, right? So the more rapidly a drug enters the brain, the more robust the dopamine release, and the more, I guess, rewarding that seems. That's why we use long-acting drugs like methadone and buprenorphine for substance use disorders, because they enter more slowly and you spread out that dopamine release. So less from a signaling standpoint and more of a pharmacokinetic standpoint. I might have lost the rest of that question.
Oh, sorry. No, I just meant, how can we potentially prevent that dopamine release from happening, because it has this reward effect, right? And we see that with lots of drugs, not only with opioids. We see that with many other substances of misuse or abuse, that we have that dopamine release. We see it with alcohol use disorders. We see it with stimulant use disorders, right? So maybe a little bit too broad of a brush that I was painting there when it comes to not only opioids, but many other drugs that have abuse potential, that it kind of boils down to this common dopamine release that kind of has that reward trigger. Which we also see with opioids.
Yeah, certainly true. Yes. And there are a lot of really good scientists here at UF and elsewhere trying to really investigate all of the mechanisms behind what that dopamine release really means to the animal, to the human, and how to try to mitigate it.
So where do you see in your research now the major implications for the future of addiction research, specifically obviously for opioid use disorders, but also in general for addiction research?
I'll just answer this by what we're trying to do. We really are focused on the respiratory depression aspect right now in the lab, because we think that, you know, curing opioid use disorder is a big task, and preventing people from dying from overdose would be a great first step in order to help get them into treatment clinics and, you know, help treat the disorder. So we're really focusing on that respiratory depression side as kind of a maybe more attainable, proximal problem to tackle. And so we do have Narcan, naloxone, available, which is great, life-saving. No question, it rapidly reverses respiratory depression from opioids pretty effectively, but it's not a perfect drug. So since it's an antagonist of the receptor, it will reverse all opioid effects at the same time, leading to withdrawal. It also is perhaps less effective at reversing fentanyl and the even more potent analogs of fentanyl, like zufentanyl. So you have to use multiple doses or even continuous infusion sometimes in order to effectively reverse those high potency agonists. So one other thing we're doing in the lab is trying to look at systems that other than the opioid receptor that might stimulate breathing. So a non-opioid way to stimulate breathing that has nothing to do with the receptor. We're right now looking at, I have a postdoc in the lab, Dr. Adrienne Varga, who just received a K99. Congratulations to her. And she's looking at norepinephrine as a potential way to stimulate breathing through a non-opioid way. I mentioned the locus coeruleus at the beginning, and this all comes back together. So the locus coeruleus projects to these neurons in the brainstem that control breathing and stimulates those neurons. So that's potentially one pathway that you could stimulate breathing, but there's many others. That's just one we're currently exploring. Mm-hmm. So that's an ideal future, I guess, if you're looking from my perspective at the best possible future outcome would be a way to stimulate breathing without affecting analgesia or withdrawal. And the NIH is on board with this too, so that helps. There's a lot of there's a lot of people looking at this now, which is
good
for the field.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you can reduce the number of overdoses and overdose deaths in particular, that's a good thing. And do you think that from your perspective, and not being necessarily an epidemiologist, but that folks who have an opioid use disorder may be, because this has been one concern with the use of naloxone and the availability of naloxone, that folks feel a little bit too safe relying potentially on naloxone as a fallback if they experience an overdose?
Yeah, I've heard that argument as well, and I don't agree with it. I mean, I think that substance use disorder is a disease, and that you wouldn't withhold chemotherapy from a cancer patient who needs it and could be life-saving. You don't hold life-saving treatment for other diseases, so there's no reason to withhold life-saving treatment for this disease either.
Yeah.
My perspective.
Yeah, I mean, there have been I've heard of especially with an increase in fentanyl now being circulating in areas where heroin injection has been occurring, and some folks even intentionally using fentanyl because they have been so used to heroin. And obviously the dosing discrepancies are just because of the potency of fentanyl, that especially rural emergency departments have been running low on naloxone drips to counteract the fentanyl.
Wow.
So that has been a concern, but I completely agree that because it is really a chronic disorder, when we talk about substance use disorders, when we talk about opioid use disorders, that any life-saving measure should definitely not be withheld, and we shouldn't look down upon, you know, it's already highly stigmatized when we talk about substance use disorders. So I completely agree with that. So that leads me kind of to the last question that I wanted to ask you. In your opinion, what do you think are kind of the biggest challenges that face the substance use disorder, the addiction research community, and society at large when we talk about substance use disorders and addiction in general?
I mean, we've already kind of talked about it a little. Destigmatizing, I think, is still really important. And the best way to get people into treatment clinics, the best way to allow research to continue is to try to help destigmatize.
Yeah.
Now, really,
yes, it is. It is. And I mean, as much has been made clear by the DSM now, DSM-5 is listing it and has been listing it in DSM, I think, since DSM-3 at least. I think that much is clear, that we have it classified as such. And you know, you've got, and many others have financial support from the NIH, and it's clear that there is an interest and society. I read recently Nixon basically started the so-called war on drugs with his initiatives, and we are now basically what, 50, 60 years later almost, and where are we now, you know, after 50 or 60 years?
A lot of things have changed since the Say No to Drugs campaign. So some progress has been made, I think. I'd like to think from the basic science side too, we understand a lot more of what's going on about with opioids in the brain and how they interact with circuitry of the brain. Of course, with anything, the more we learn, the more we know that we need to learn more.
More questions come up, right?
Right, exactly. So a lot more questions are opening. Something we haven't even talked about that I have stumbled upon now in the breathing area is that people who take opioids chronically have significant sleep disorder breathing. And that's something that really could use a lot of understanding and intervention. So it's a pretty interesting area.
Yeah. So is that, do And that's a question that let me just briefly touch on that before we close. But so somebody who has an opioid use disorder is switching to buprenorphine or methadone, do they continue to experience, for example, such effects like insomnia or sleep disorders? Is that a continuous issue that they struggle with?
Yes, in fact, it's pretty high prevalence. It depends the study, you know, which study you look at, but up to 70 to 75 people on methadone have sleep disordered breathing in some form, obstructive sleep apnea or central sleep apnea. So pretty high prevalence. And that, if you interfere with sleep, that can interfere with your ability to recover and your cognitive ability. So,
So there's a whole tale of different disorders that come along with the central opioid use disorder, with the chronic condition of a substance use disorder that kind of, we know about chronic disorders that accompany it, cardiovascular disorders and gastrointestinal disorders that can accompany not only opioid but substance use disorders in general. When you talk about stimulant or opioid use disorders, where often chronic constipation is accompanied by it, and all kinds of this tail of disorders that
drug-induced disorders.
Drug-induced disorders, so it's I think we often sometimes don't realize, you just see them as a substance use disorder patient, but there's so much more that comes along with it that is just that we might sometimes not even realize. And obviously then depression, anxiety, all of these other associated disorders or states that just comes along with it. Definitely something that practitioners should keep in mind, that also society or their social environment should keep in mind. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Levitt. I really appreciate you sharing your insights, what is going on in your lab, and I think it's in your research group. And I think it's a very important task to then take what you do in the basic sciences into the clinical setting, and it has obviously the direct applicability. Cannot wait to see what publications come out of your lab next and out of your research group. Thank you for taking the time today to talk to me and to share your insights with our listeners.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me. It was a great conversation.
Thank you. And thank you to all of you for listening in today. And watch out for our next podcast. Take care, everybody.